interview with the author.
We're here today at home with Paul Auster. I'm Robert Allen with Macmillan Audio, and thank you, Paul, for agreeing to do this interview.
Thank you for trekking all the way out to Brooklyn.
We're going to be focusing largely on the audiobook today. Paul has just completed reading, I believe the program ended up being 35 and a half hours. Paul has spent most of August with us in the studio, and you have recorded your most recent audiobooks, at least in most states anyway.
My work of the last 15 years, I think I've done, if not every single book, just about all of them, yeah.
It's a little unusual for authors to read. It's great. We love it. Any particular reason why you were interested in reading?
Well, number one is I enjoy reading. I find it most interesting. And in fact, even as I'm writing a book, you know, I live with a writer, Siri Hustvedt, a great writer, and she's my first reader. And every 20 or 30 or 40 pages or so, when I'm working on the manuscript, we sit down and I read out loud to her. And I find that reading out loud clarifies everything for me. I can hear where I've gone wrong. So it's very helpful. I like the idea of reading aloud. I think having children taught me a lot about how to do it. And now that they're all grown up, I don't have a chance to read to them anymore. I've always enjoyed giving readings in public. It's one of the few public activities of a writer that I don't mind. And I've been giving readings since, I suppose the first ones were in the late 60s when I was at Columbia. We had a thing called the poem team. And we went around to different colleges giving readings. And so I'm an old hand at it, really.
So when you actually record, it's not the first time you've read it out loud. You've already done it before.
Not at all. That's right. You know, because, how can I put it, a book is made of words, and those words have a music to them. And it's necessary for the reader, the one who's reading out loud, to understand the music. And who better than the author himself?
That's great. I just listened to most of the program in the last few days, and I must say, I think you do a great job with it. It's just, it's hearing it in your voice, you hear the rhythms, and it's really absolutely wonderful. This is probably the longest program you've recorded, though.
Not probably, yeah. It definitely is.
What did you do to keep the stamina? Because you sound as good, it sounds as good towards the end as it was at the beginning.
It's remarkable, because I have to say, we were recording in the heat of August in New York, and it was a particularly humid, hot, torrid month, and I had to, you know, get myself into Manhattan every day. So I was half exhausted by the time I arrived, and then, but mercifully, it was air conditioned in there, so it wasn't so bad. And we did stretch it out. I think there were 10 recording days total, but we stretched that over 3 different weeks. So there was not a week in which I read 5 straight days, I don't think. And that helped.
Yeah, that helped. It must have. With 4321, the new program, the new book, you have a very innovative and, I think, very accessible at the same time structure to the book. How did you end up coming up with that idea?
I don't know. I've never been able to track the birth of an idea. One second, nothing is there. Another second, something is there. The thing is there. And one day it was there, and I understood this was how to do it. I think all my life I've been thinking about, you know, the question of potential other lives that all of us could have led if this had been a little different or that had been a little different, if we turned right instead of left that day. All the myriad contingencies on which a life is formed. I'd always wanted to do something with this idea. And then when I figured out that I was going to limit it to 4 possible Fergusons, not 6 or 9 or 20, but 4, I understood the best way to tell it would be rotating cycles so that you're reading all the stories at the same time rather than one after another after another.
because you're dealing with four different versions of Ferguson, was it hard keeping straight what you put in one version as opposed to another, or did it just become organic?
It wasn't hard. I don't know why. It was all there, and I didn't have to think about it too much. I did, you know, make certain lists at various moments in the book, knowing what I wanted to do in any given cycle. Mm-hmm. But these notes were not very elaborate at all. Just little notations, really.
I was actually looking at the galley of the book, and when you're reading the book, you have some clues to which character you're going to be reading about next by the sort of numeric codes that
you have.
The chapter heads.
Yeah, well, it begins with a kind of overture, which is 1.0. And that tells the story of Ferguson's parents, how they met, married, and at the last sentence, Ferguson is born. And then the cycles begin, 1.1, followed by 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, and then 2.1. So there are seven cycles altogether.
Were there any, or were you tempted to use any sort of verbal clues or audio clues as you were reading it?
Well, by the end of the book, we understand that it's all written by Ferguson IV.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the voice is consistent, and it is a third-person authorial voice, almost a voice of a deity, looking down and telling mm-hmm. the story of these people. So there's really no difference in tone. What the boys do, the different iterations of Ferguson, varies, but the language itself of the narration doesn't change.
Yes, and when you're reading and listening to it, you sort of quickly, as you move into each section, you do have content clues that sort of
yes.
let you know.
Well, I thought it was very important. So, for example, Ferguson 3, there's a chapter that ends with him in a kind of miserable rage throwing money out of the window. And then, of course, then you're reading more Fergusons. And so the next time you see that Ferguson, Ferguson 3, the chapter begins, you know, 39 days after he threw the money out of the window, such and such happened.
It picks up.
So I think any readers paying the slightest bit of attention will know exactly where he is.
No, it's surprisingly
yeah.
easy
yeah.
to... I think I was telling you earlier that when I would finish a section, I'd think, oh, I'm going to miss this character.
Yeah.
But then you get into the new character, and it's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember I love this character,
too. It sucked you
yeah.
in, I hope. Because I did a conversation with somebody yesterday, and she confessed that after that moment of the money going out the window, she wanted to jump ahead and see what happened next. She read maybe a page, and she said, no, this is not the way to do
yeah.
it. And she went back and read the book in order.
But it leaves you wanting more at the end of each section, which is great. Did you have a particular favorite of the versions?
No, not really.
All your children?
Not really. I mean
love
to say, you know, the boy who dies young, that I love that boy. The one who starts his own newspaper at age 11 and comes up with his zinger 1-2 punch headline that he loves so much. Fracas and Caracas. He just can't get over
yeah.
how amusing those words are to him. And you have to love a boy like that.
And you do feel a real sense of loss.
That's horrible. It was horrible. Yeah.
One of the things that I really liked that you did in the book is that you left the chapter heads, the numbers for him, as you were going through each cycle.
I thought, and people have told me, it had the effect I wanted, which was when you get to the first blank page,
mm-hmm.
it's like a knife in the heart.
Yes.
Yeah. And you mourn him. It's as if you're visiting the cemetery with that blank page.
No, it's very effective.
Yeah.
One of the things you also do, which I really liked a lot, is sort of the way you incorporated events and to historical events to sort of anchor a scene into a place and time. Were those things that you, I mean, for example, Attica was included, the Kennedy assassination, the, I think he even talked about the Weathermen.
The Columbia Revolution.
The Columbia.
Newark riots.
Yeah.
Various things in the civil rights movement. Well, it's a life and times of, and, but if you notice, particular attention to the political climate is focused in Ferguson One, the one who becomes a journalist. He's the one most involved in this. Ferguson Three is not involved. He's bored by politics. Mm-hmm. There are a few mentions of what's going on in his chapters, but not to the degree that they are in Ferguson One. And Ferguson Four, the one who becomes a fiction writer, well, he's interested. He's paying close attention, but he's not an activist.
Yes.
So they all have different relations to what's going on around them. Number two, the one whose life is the shortest, he is very alert to what's going on. He's a nascent political thinker already, mm-hmm. at age 13 or so.
In these events that you represent in the book, are there ones that had sort of a personal significance?
They all do. I mean, I was at Columbia when all this happened. I was not a reporter for the Columbia Spectator, the daily student paper. I did write for them, but only to do book and movie reviews. Mm-hmm. But I was in one of the buildings. I was an occupier of Mathematics Hall. But in the novel itself, my Ferguson is a reporter. Now, it's interesting you should bring up this bit, because in those Columbia chapters, I think there are two of them, there are four people I mentioned by name. They're real people, and these are classmates of mine. And I sent them the manuscript so that they could give me their permission to use their real names. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted them to be there. So Mark Rudd, who's the head of Columbia SDS, someone not only whom I went to college with, but high school as well. So we've known each other all our lives. Mark, who was the leader of that movement, read the book. He said to me, and I must say, it made me feel good. He said, "This is the definitive version of what happened at Columbia.
Wow.
You didn't get a single thing wrong. It's all correct." So that is, I was writing history in a sense, mm-hmm. there. Robert Friedman, who was the editor of the Columbia Spectator, still an important journalist in New York, he signed off on everything. He said, "Fine," and "Thank you." And Hilton Obenzinger, who's a real person, he's still one of my dear friends. He lives in California now. He did, in 1969, go around the classroom building at Columbia, Hamilton Hall, with ground beef in his hands, and open up classrooms and fling the meat against the blackboards, yelling out the word "meat." And everyone appreciated Hilton's Dada sense of humor. It seemed to somehow embody some of the nuttiness of the era. And then, interestingly, Les Gottesman, who's mentioned by name, is the author of the poem with that one line. Am I able to say it on this?
Yes, please do.
It was in the Columbia Review, the undergraduate literary magazine, and the poem had the refrain, "A steady fuck is good for you." Now, when this was given to me, I was still in high school. It was the day of my interview at Columbia. The teacher who interviewed me gave me the magazine, and I read that. I laughed out loud on the subway. And I said, "This is the college I definitely want to go to. If they allow people to publish poems like this, then this is this will be a good place for me." The Newark riots, I lived through. My mother and stepfather and sister were living in Newark at the time. So I saw this firsthand. Attica, I was already living in Paris by 1971. Mm-hmm. But I read all about it, and it was one of the most shocking events of the era.
Yeah.
Nauseating, the way Rockefeller just summarily sent out these people to shoot down the not only the prisoners, but the guards. The guards were shooting guards. And I didn't put it in the book, but apparently a day or two after Nixon was president, called up Rockefeller, you know, to ask him what the hell had happened. And Rockefeller kind of shrugged. He said, well, you know, 40 people were killed, but that's life.
Hmm.
So he had no remorse whatsoever.
Wow.
Yeah.
You've referenced some real people that are in the book. And when you listen and read the book, there does seem to be, or you feel like there could be, other autobiographical facts in
the
book.
There are some. It's remarkably not an autobiographical book, even though the book is centered in the part of the world where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
All the geography of the book is my geography. I borrowed my grandparents' apartment on West 58th Street. I use it, but these people are not my grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my mother was not a professional photographer, et cetera, et cetera. One event, though, that I took directly from life, which maybe sounds like the most far-fetched event in the book, or one of them, is the basketball game that Ferguson IV participates in when he's 14 years old. A Y team from the suburbs playing another Y team from the inner city of Newark. Seven white boys in a gym filled with about 100 black kids. And our game went into triple overtime, just as I wrote it in the book. Mm-hmm. And we were losing by a point with a few seconds to go. And one of our players took a blind heave from midcourt, swished it at the buzzer, and we won.
Wow.
By a point, and the stands emptied, and everyone tried to beat us up, and we got out of there by the skin of our teeth. It was a very depressing moment
yeah.
for me about race relations in America. And what the future held for all of us, and so that's in the book, and that's a real event. I mean, a few other things come from real life, and then there are some other characters like Pierre Matisse, the owner of the gallery on 57th mm-hmm. Street, who was Henri Matisse's son. But Pierre was a friend of mine. I wrote and translated for him catalogs back in the 70s. Somebody I liked enormously, and he's the person who gives Ferguson and Amy catalogs from the gallery when they show up for a Giacometti show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the kind of thing Pierre would have done. And I just wanted to make a little salute mm-hmm. to him in the book. Yeah.
The book begins with somewhat of a joke, which results in
his
name Ferguson. Was that did you just make that up, or was that a story you'd
No, it's a
heard?
Real joke. It's a real joke, and I hadn't heard it. And so,
would you mind sort of repeating?
A few years ago, as it says in the book, Ferguson Ford, he found out it was a joke that had been circulating mm-hmm. for a long time, but he had never heard it. And it's a joke about the Jewish immigrant who arrives at Ellis Island with a Russian Jewish immigrant with a long, unpronounceable name. And an older compatriot says to him, you know, you have to change your name. You need a better name for your new life in America, something shorter. And the young one says, well, what do you suggest? He said, Rockefeller. Tell him you're Rockefeller. You can't go wrong with that. So, young man, okay, I'll tell them I'm Rockefeller. But a couple of hours go by before he has a chance to sit down with an immigration official. And when the man asks him what his name is, the young man slaps his head, and he says in Yiddish, "Ich hab vergessen, I've forgotten." And so he's called Ichabod Ferguson, and that's how he gets his name. So the joke begins the book, and then it's picked up again right at the end.
Yeah, I love the way you ended that as well. I mean, names seem to be rather important throughout the book in terms of names that people choose, like Ferguson decides to go by Ferguson and not by Archie.
Each one of
the brothers all have a different name.
Exactly. Each one of the Fergusons becomes a writer of one sort or another, but different. You know, a journalist, a film critic, and memoirist, and a novelist, and they all decide to use different names. The first one is he's Archibald Isaac Ferguson. So, and they hate the name Archibald. Archie's a nice name for everyday use, but it feels kind of ridiculous to put it on a book or an article. Mm-hmm. So the first one becomes AI Ferguson, right? But Ferguson 3, who is much less pretentious, I suppose, than the others, he just goes with Archie. He doesn't want to be Archibald, but Archie. And then the last one, who turns into the novelist, mm-hmm. Uses his middle name. So he becomes Isaac Ferguson. One of the problems with Archie is that numbskull in the comic books, it's just that, it's a name that very few Americans have, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Archibald.
It is.
Archie, yeah. So, I bet somehow those choices reveal a lot about the characters mm-hmm. themselves, yeah.
Going back to the Columbia, the riots and there were in the 60s, I mean, a large part of this is set in the 60s, mm-hmm. and 60s, there was a lot of upheaval in the 60s, and are there any parallels between the time we were writing about in the 60s and sort of what we're going through now with all the...
I feel that, of course, things are different, the circumstances are different, but the underlying problems are the same. And what we're going through in America today feels as dire as what we were going through then.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in terms of black-white relations, we really haven't gotten very far. Many good things have happened in these intervening 50 years, but not enough. Not enough for us to feel good about ourselves as a society. Improvements, yes, but miles and miles and miles to go before, you know, we can even begin to think of ourselves as a just country who treats everybody equally.
And I think with President Obama being our first African-American president, there was maybe a false sense of
I think we had achieved something. Yes, I agree. And in fact, his very presence in the White House opened a box out of which many devils have flown.
Mm-hmm.
And there was what they call a backlash. And I've never seen a president more disrespected than Obama has been. It's unprecedented in American history. Lincoln, I suppose,
mm-hmm.
disrespected by the South. But other than that, there's been nothing like it.
So how long did you spend in Paris when you...
I moved there in early February of 71. And I came back in July of 74. But I didn't live in Paris the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
The first 2.5 years, yes. But the last year, I lived in the south of France as a caretaker of a farmhouse.
Very
isolated place. Really in the middle.
So you're in France, but not
in France. Paris. Yeah, but hundreds of miles away from Paris.
Thank you so much for being with us here today and agreeing to talk with us and have this conversation. I think this is going to be a wonderful audio book for everyone that has a chance to listen to it, and appreciate you.